Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the regular board meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District for Tuesday, October 2nd. The board met in closed session, we discussed a stipulated expulsion. Would someone like to make a motion on that, please?
That we accept the stipulated expulsion as presented.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Let's move on to item number 3.02, consensus on the order of business. Do we have a consensus on the order of business? All right, seeing that, let's go to the minutes for October 2nd. I'm sorry, the minutes for September 18th.
Which will be under the lights this year, which is a change from last year when it was earlier in the day. And then we'll have our dance on the 27th and all of our activities throughout that week. Other than that, we're just continuing that new school spirit that we have, and everything's good. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. As always, you're welcome to stay and participate. Or please feel free to leave whenever you're ready. We know you've got a lot of stuff and that you're probably real busy. Let's move on to public comment. And actually, correspondence. The board did receive we'll go to public comment. Is there anyone from the public that would like to address the board on an item in front of it? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back. Now let's move on to correspondence. The board did not receive correspondence as a board. However, each individual board member did, via email, I believe, and tonight's meeting, receive a letter from a parent of a special education student. And I'm not going, for confidentiality purposes, I'm not going to name that. Let's move on to item number 7, superintendent's updates. Dr. Prater.
Yes, before we get started, I just would like to acknowledge a former superintendent that served our district for a number of years. We received news, the sad news, that Dr. Ed Denton passed, I believe, last week in Massachusetts. And I think it serves the board well to hear that that we're acknowledging him and the efforts and the things that he did for our school district for a number of years. Including reading recovery.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. President. Not a whole lot to report on the state side of things. Once again, we continue to await the November election, and each day it grows a little closer. The problem is that the point differences between the fours and the against the Proposition 30 also begin to get closer and closer. So the polling numbers aren't getting any more favorable. Although they do still have a positive rating, and it's going to be a very, very close and tight race. For those who have an interest, I think it would be a great opportunity in November to make sure you get out and vote. It's a good cause one way or the other.
Mr. Miller, would you just remind everyone who's in the meeting this evening and who might be watching us on television what the impact to the district would be should Proposition 30 fail?
Yes, sir. Thank you. What would happen is that what the governor has stated is that he would be forced to impose a $454 per student cut on all districts across the board in the state should Proposition 30 fail. For San Luis Coastal, that will equate to approximately $3.2 million in fair share with revenue limit districts. It's added to a current fair share payment that we have to the state for the deficit factor that revenue limit districts are already paying of $4.5 million. So somewhere between $7.5 and $8 million will be our fair share of pain if Proposition 30 does not pass.
So we're talking about around 10% of our current budget. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Thank you. Dr. Prater?
Dr. Prater.
And I would like to participate in half of the budget update. Last week I participated in a conference, the annual fall conference for urban city superintendents that gather annually in Millbrae, California. I decided to join this conference because I was curious as to what the discussions were regarding weighted student formula. The city or more urban settings where there's far more diversity, they are the ones that will benefit the most from a weighted student formula finance reform effort. So I decided to attend. It was worth my while. I listened to Joel Montero, who is the FICMAT CEO, and he presented for well over an hour and spoke very clearly about what will happen with weighted student formula, and he tied it directly to Prop 30. So he created his own formula, if you will, and what he said was that the governor is deadly serious about re-energizing weighted student formula, and he's tying that to the passage of Prop 30. So it's my understanding from hearing from Joel Montero, so in that case, I just wanted to paint that picture. I also listened to Ron Bennett and Kevin Gordon, and their projections, their assumptions are nothing new to our ears. It's still more of the same. We need to build our budgets with the given these circumstances. We should build our budgets with the assumption that Prop 30 does not pass. In our case, that deepens the severity of the conversation or the seriousness of our budget development process and the conversations we need to have. Just wanted to share that news with you.
Okay. Any questions for Dr. Prater?
Yes, I have one. I know that those of us who are here understand the concept of weighted student formula, but for anyone who might be watching, could you just in brief describe what that term means?
Yeah, the weighted student formula is where the amount of funding that is provided for each child under the revenue limit changes by virtue of their subgroup status or identifier. So students who are identified in poverty or English learners or have a who are part of the achievement gap, if you will, those students carry more money with them in terms of the contribution from the state. Oppositely, those that are in the higher performing non-achievement gap group would receive less funding. So our revenue limit amount would decline. We would receive less under that model than what we would normally receive. We already have a low revenue limit in the county, one of the lowest in the county, I believe. And so this sort of sets the stage to almost put their foot in the door to paint a pretty dire situation for districts who do not have large diversity populations, but are still trying to do incredible things for kids and programs. So Joel Montero, I'll just go back to this one more time. He did say something that caught my attention. He flat out said that weighted student formula is a loser for everybody. And he said that in California because there's winners and there's losers. And it's about a 50-50. Winners to losers. So half the districts in California would make out well, and you don't need to think too hard about who would benefit from this. And those that don't may have that diverse makeup would lose revenue in an already shrinking revenue environment. So that's the weighted student formula in a nutshell. How that impacts basic aid districts is still up to interpretation. But I can say to you, if our neighbor revenue limit districts lose revenue limit amounts because of this weighted student formula, which in large measure they would, I can guarantee you basic aid school districts will have a larger fair share at minimum. So it's not something that I look forward to if that passes.
And I think it's fair to say that it's interesting to look at where the power of where the legislative districts are located, which are primarily in the large urban districts, who would tend to gain the most from a weighted student formula. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Unger?
Yes, of course.
May I ask a question? Did Mr. Montero speak to what would happen to our district in particular if the Molly Munger initiative passed and 30 did not pass?
You know, Joel Montero, the question of the Munger initiative never came up during this as a serious candidate for consideration. It just did not come up. In large measure, the biggest news I would say that I got, and I haven't validated or verified this, but it's certainly of concern to me. It's my understanding that that the Administrative Association, ACSA, wrote a confirming recommendation, if you will, to Governor Brown and Daryl Steinberg supporting a weighted student formula. So I'm still pursuing evidence of that. That's just what a fellow superintendent, a friend of mine, told me, and he's at the Occalani School District, and his district just slipped into basic aid, so now he's very concerned about this. So he was the one that told me this, and I'm pursuing that as I want to get the evidence first to ensure that that's in fact taken place.
What I recall from Mr. Miller in a previous report was that our district would actually fare better under
take the equivalent amount of money that would have raised and remove it from Prop 98, which they have the legal right to do, and which in fact is a matter of a lawsuit right now. But it doesn't look good. The state being able to define what goes into Proposition 98 for purposes of school revenues and being able to manipulate that. So, he's pretty much made up his mind. Speaking of budgets, would you like to go on to 7.02, the budget development process?
That's a loaded question. I think it's important for us to continue the discussion about budget development in the process. And I very much appreciate, once again, thank you for your involvement and your recommendations from the last board meeting. And essentially what I heard and what I'm changing is the timeline. We're going to hurry up the timeline. We're going to move forward this month and start the educational process, if you will, about as much as we know where we've been, where we're looking at best recommendations, and getting thoughts from each group so that not every group meets in the month of October, but over the months of October and November, then I anticipate being able to get in front of or have conversations with somehow all of these different groups that we've talked about. It's going to become an issue about how we approach the budget because ultimately, as Eric was relating to us on his return from Sacramento, Joel Montero, the people from school services, the people from SINA have all recommended that at least I think three basic things happen. One is conserve your cash. Number two is watch carefully your programs and determine which ones benefit kids the most. If you have to cut, then cut those last. And first and foremost among all other consideration is conserve your people. Do everything you can in order to keep your people on board and delivering, because instruction for kids happens with people in the classrooms, and any attempt to compromise that kind of a delivery model will end up hurting kids. So those are the three things that we're going to be talking about. But obviously, the issues of cutting let's say it's $7.5 million. It's going to create some pain, and we're going to have good involvement, great discussion, and very good thinking about all of those outcomes. So it's a difficult year to talk about budget and budget process, but it's a problem defined by somebody else, not us. And we just have to keep in mind that our strength is in our people, and our strength is in the things that we know work. And so we need to define what those are from all different viewpoints and then put those together in a recommendation to Dr. Prater, who then will have the conversation with the board. With the board's permission, just to say it directly, I think that the board's involvement is about over with at this point. I think that you guys will be on vacation, if you will, until April or May. And when Dr. Prater gets his recommendations formatted, we will then include the board once again in the conversation and get your input and feedback. Of course, I will give you updates, and you'll be brought along with progress or lack thereof if it happens that way. But ultimately, your conversations and your involvement will be on vacation for a while, if that's okay.
Comments from board members? Okay, seeing none, let's move on to item number 7.03, Student Support Services, a report on the Family Resource Center and California Healthy Kids Survey, and that's going to be presented by Mr. Dowler and Mr. Warren, I believe.
I think it's Mr. Warren first.
And Mr. Warren, and Warren, Mr. Warren,
how are you?
Warren
and
Dowler.
Thank you very much for having me. Frank Warren, Division Manager of Prevention and Outreach for the Behavioral Health Department. For those of you who don't know, that's Drug and Alcohol Services and Mental Health. I'm both. And very happy to be here to talk about your Healthy Kids Survey results. It's been a couple years since I've presented to the board, but this is a great opportunity for every district to take a snapshot of where their young people are in terms of risk behaviors around alcohol or other drugs, as well as the survey now captures asset building, youth development principles, ideas around bullying, and some wellness indicators as well. So I'm going to rattle through here and hopefully be able to answer some questions ahead of time, but of course I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have as we go on. First of all, and you can just kind of keep – I don't think I have a clicker here, so you can click Kim whenever and I'll just keep talking. Your entire district participated in such substance within the last 30 days. Clearly, in this district, as will be pretty much shown throughout the other districts, alcohol remains the most used drug. It's been the most used drug for all the years I've been involved in this report, and it will continue to be. It's the one thing that we've yet to really figure out how to make a major impact on. The good news is we're not growing those numbers of users, but there are some things I'll point out that we may want to keep a focus on. Marijuana does continue to be used more regularly by our students here in this district, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. The most important thing is that we focus on the number one statistic, and that is a vast majority of our young people are not using alcohol or other drugs. And I think that's the one thing that gets lost in when we start talking about these numbers is, wow, that slide is really, wow, interesting. That's okay. I'll tell you what it really says. We should be very proud of the fact that we have kept this number high for the last few years, this non-use number. This is really important, and it should be the first thing that our adults lead the discussion with, that our normal is very much the majority of young people do not use on a regular basis or use at all, and that could be alcohol or any other kind of drug. We also know that student perception is completely skewed. In fact, if you ask the 11th graders in this district how many of your friends or how many peers use marijuana, they say 98% do, when in fact only 49% have ever reported using once in their life. So there is this sense of what is normal and what we say is normal that is somewhat different. Thanks, Kim. So I'll give you a quick look here at – oh, there's the rest of the slide. This is really just testing all of your ability to stay awake at this hour. Okay, so in the next slide, what you'll see is the... You won't see it. I'll see it. We'll look at that lifetime number. Now, if you look at this lifetime number, it doesn't really tell you a whole lot other than the fact that the number one, the top number there is your district. And your district looks very similar to the numbers for the county, which is the first number underneath, and the state, which is the second number underneath. Those numbers in red are where we've seen a 5-point change over the last three reports. And we clearly see it in marijuana. Now, this is not regular use. This is the amount of young people who admit to using it once in their life. Why is that going up here? Well, it's going up everywhere. And the reason that we see that is we have in our state medical marijuana. We have more parents who use. The drug is more accessible. And it's also becoming a little bit easier to admit I used. So these numbers may 2 years ago have been very similar, but as we become a culture that talks more openly about the drug, we are seeing a difference there. I included painkillers because I get a lot of questions about prescription drugs. It really is the one that comes up a lot when I'm asked by parents. And one of the good news factors is that we've seen a 5-point reduction in lifetime use of painkillers. But I want to caution you when you look at any of the questions in the Healthy Survey around illegal or prescription drugs or painkillers, we don't ask the question very well. This is the one issue with this survey I've always had, which is we don't ask, have you used a prescription drug without having a prescription for it or abused that prescription? The way the question is asked, it's very easy for a young person to misunderstand. So I don't put a lot of weight into that number. But if we look at 30-day use, which is on the next slide, you can see that your district has stayed very steady. There are very slight upticks in some of your numbers, but none more than a 4-point move, all staying within the margin of error in this survey. The one that we did see a larger leap was in marijuana. Again, over the last three reports, we've seen that increase with our younger users. Now, I've also looked at binge drinking over time, and I will point out that 27% of your juniors who report binge drinking, as you know, which we also call over drinking, more than 4 or 5 drinks in a short amount of time, depending on your gender, that was at a very low 24% a few years ago, but it had been up as high as in the mid-30s. Within the last decade. So we are seeing good, strong increases. There is a reason for that, and I will say this about your district and a lot of our districts. We have come around the corner to be able to talk about harm reduction that we weren't able to do 10, 15 years ago when it was very much a zero-tolerance approach. We do now acknowledge that alcohol exists, and we acknowledge that people drink in large amounts, and we can talk with our young people about reducing that amount. Of course, we want to present a zero-tolerance message, but I think this open discussion and the way we talk about this behavior has changed for the good. Thank you, Kim. And so let me just give you a few of the indicators. I'm really sorry about how these slides worked out. Very slight increases, as I pointed out, including the use of alcohol. I was reporting to you that our females were drinking clearly more than our males, and that has started to change. We now see it with our younger females, but it is not across the board anymore like it has been, at least in this district. The things that I look for that I also get concerned about are the amount of young people who, when they use, are using to get very high or drunk, and we still see that number, I think, at a point where we should discuss it. 52% of 11th graders saying they drink to get feel it a lot or get really drunk. Some might say, well, why else would you? But we also know that we have this mixed message that we give young people about alcohol being part of our society and social this or whatever. I think that's a telling number. Our juniors and freshmen say it's very easy to get alcohol. That number is decreasing a little bit, which is exciting, but that still remains a major focus for us when we look at these surveys. And you can see, whereas alcohol may be getting more difficult to get their hands on, marijuana is rising in access, as well as the number of young people in 7th and 9th grades who say they've been offered illegal drugs while on campus.
Frank, I'm going to say this. This young females report drinking more than males. That's really a concern to me because it really puts children at risk. Because I'm imagining that these are young women who will grow into older, more mature women who will have babies, and we know that no amount of alcohol is good for a fetus.
Well, I will say this. In the last two reports, every age group of females has reported more alcohol use than males, whether it's by, you know, 5 points or 2 points. It's been consistent. This is the first time I've seen the report in the last few reports, and I go back to about 97 when I look at these, that we've seen it primarily with 7th and 9th and not with 11th. So I do think that means we're starting to get that message through, possibly, that there is a gender difference in the effect of alcohol, especially when it comes to reproductive issues. Of course, the message should be that it's unhealthy for everybody, but we are seeing some changes there. Whether they stay as a trend, I can't predict, but I think that's an interesting thing to discuss. And we'll keep going here, and I will let you know that we also look for perceived harm. Now, our county has always had a very low perceived harm of alcohol use. Now, we also are in wine country, and we have a major university right here, and young people see alcohol used on a regular basis. It becomes a little bit less taboo when it's so out in the open, and so the harm rate starts to lower. The state, which used to, the peers across the state who used to think alcohol was far more dangerous, they're starting to see it far less dangerous, which means we're starting to average out with the state. But our perceived harm for marijuana is much lower than state rates. The other thing that I always find fascinating when I started back in 94, it was, trying to walk through all the smokers, the cigarette smokers to get on campus. And the cigarette smokers are gone, but they are using alcohol and marijuana use on campus, as I reported earlier.
This may be a point to ask this question. It seems that as we look at these reports over time, we've made a major impact on tobacco use.
Yes.
And we're not making similar impacts over similar periods of time on alcohol, marijuana.
I would say we've made very significant impacts on high-risk behaviors like binge drinking. I do think that the issue of marijuana in terms of education and prevention is very different now. If you've heard me give this, talk before, we were very easily able to identify a victim with cigarette smoke back in the 80s and 90s, and that changed people's presence of norm about cigarette smoke. It's very difficult to do that with marijuana because it's an illegal drug. Alcohol, the really only significant public policy changes were made when we identified drunk driving victims. Again, binge drinking because of alcohol overdose has started to identify victims. Once you identify victims, you can get people to change norms. That's going to be interesting to see what happens with marijuana. So when we talk to young people, one of the strategies is identifying consequence. And we were able to do that very clearly with cigarettes. But it's very easy to isolate that behavior. It's very visible. Whereas alcohol can be an invisible activity. So I'm probably getting further along in that issue, but we are seeing the same thing.
And I guess part of my question, I dropped the word perceived, and the perception of marijuana is different than, but it seems to me, as I think back on it, there was a national effort, a state effort, the tobacco, anti-tobacco ads were prevalent on television. I'm not seeing anything along those lines on anti-alcohol and anti-marijuana ads.
Because there was an industry to sue and take a lot of money from to fund all those things. Which is impossible test, where we measured their 30-day use of marijuana, alcohol, or other drugs. We made significant changes in people going from some use to zero use. That's really important, as well as reducing people who were high users, very frequent users of those drugs. And so we continue to study this. We also have really great data on the reduction in other mental health concerns, suicidal ideations, depression scales, things like that. And the last slide is one that I share at the end of this presentation whenever I do it, which is the things that we continue to reiterate with our schools, with our districts. One, and I think this is where San Luis Coastal does very well, having established very clear policies that include counseling. Counseling is a way of letting young people know that this problem has a lot of root factors to it. It's not just a behavior issue. And so counseling is something that I think has to be part of that. Infiltration. We really encourage our schools to not make this just about what the health teacher says or the Friday Night Live advisor says. This really has to be something that the entire campus embraces as a value. And then finally, curriculum, finding ways in everyday curriculum, whether it's English or math. And I'm sorry, Kai, because we were just talking about AP Stats, who could take these surveys and really do a lot of work with it, and while at the same time talk about these issues. I encourage that as well. And that's all I have. I don't know if there's more questions.
I think you were touching on what I was thinking about. Would it be possible to take the graph that you had two slides back that showed the progress of a student in recovery? Mm-hmm. Would you be able to tie in performance in school to as they're mm-hmm. reducing their usage?
Yes. Yes.
Because that's kind of what we're about.
This survey isn't equipped to do that, but we can show you the correlates of young people who reported less use and how their grades or attendance improved. So we do have those correlations.
Perfect.
In this survey that we do with these young people.
That would be very helpful. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and I can put more of that together and share it with Chris Daller.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just have a question about the data gathering, and maybe it's because I grew up in the don't trust anyone over 30
yes.
era. And how reliable is the self-reporting? I mean, do students really believe that it's anonymous? Is there a greater margin of error
yeah.
than there might be in
yeah.
other kinds of surveys?
That's one of the reasons why we like the survey and why we were very much, I think a lot of us in the community, when the state was looking at eliminating the survey for funding, really lobbied that they keep it. One of the reasons is because it does vet out some of that natural air of mistrust. You also, if you look at the trends over time, and you know, we keep it all in our office, and I know your offices have it too, you don't see great fluctuation. You see it very steady, and it measures very well up against the state's other survey they do. It's it's done out of the Attorney General's office and California Student Survey. And when you see that the numbers stay relatively the same, you recognize that it's a pretty well-vetted, they do have a lot of, they have dummy questions in it where they kind of test young people to see, and those are screened out. So at the beginning of your, if you actually get a copy of the survey, the first few pages will show you how many were given the survey, yet how many were actually recorded, because they do screen out maybe 100 per class. I'm giving an estimate there.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is the survey still as lengthy as it used to be? It used to be rather lengthy, I mean.
Much longer.
Oh.
And the reason that it's, and I won't say much, it is longer. We've tended to really want to know about bullying. It's an important topic. And so bullying has taken a really good presence in it. We still ask a lot of tobacco questions, which gives us good, you know, long-term, you know, looks back. But we haven't eliminated anything from the survey over the years, but we have added.
With this level of data, and no doubt other surveys, is it possible to make any assessments of some of the prevention programs that we tried through the early 2000s and beyond, DARE, things like that? Any idea of the efficacy of those things?
Again, it would be correlation, and the survey does ask, I have been involved in a prevention program. It also says, I have talked with someone about my drug and alcohol issue. Unfortunately, it screens only those who admit to being in use. So a young person who's never used or maybe used once but hasn't used in the last 30 days, they don't get to answer that question saying, I'm involved in a prevention program, which, of course, we would want to say what was that so we can give it some credit. You can look at a district and say, okay, here's the cadre of prevention opportunities we've offered, and look at that cohort of young people and to see how they've done over time. You could.
Dangers are better known in the public, and it's probably spread throughout the community through all of the attempts to on the lawsuits, if I remember. So are there community outreach efforts that are going on either through your department or through other areas to get this word out? Because, I mean, we have data that we can share, and I'm wondering, does it end here at the school board, or do we take it out?
I think every community deals with it a little bit differently.
Okay.
For instance, I just got back from a meeting in Atascadero where they have a large group of community people who have put together this Lighthouse Foundation. They're seeing a lot of overdose issues and high-end use issues of drugs. They have lobbied some new programming that they're doing in partnership with their school district. Some of those things include county activities. Some of them are being done separately from the county. So I do track that. Every community does it a little bit differently. We've seen a great kind of closing up of all the youth task forces we had for a number of years. Those kind of have gone away. There's a few that still exist. South County has a very strong one. Every community deals with it a little bit differently. Every school district deals with it differently. I'm not at every school district doing this presentation, I'll tell you that. I'm available, and I'll put my number on the screen or something. Because we love to get it out and talk about it, but every district does it a little differently.
Okay. The follow-up question would be, would a concerted effort to reach out to the community through the PTAs, through the service clubs? It seems to me if we're looking at that asset development umbrella of we need everybody involved, and Mr. Noir's comment about tobacco, mm-hmm. that seems an effective way to...
I think it is. The hard part is sustaining. This district has seen a number of parent-driven efforts over the last 10, 20 years that have come and gone. I think the one constant that I've always remind people is the one constant is you still have the schools. And the schools really can make the most impact. I really encourage in-service training. I really encourage schools to talk with faculty about how to identify a problem that may not look like an alcohol or drug problem, but we can give them indicators to look for so that they can get that young person engaged earlier. So there are things that we can do that will have a long-term impact on those numbers. But the community owns this as much as the school. This is definitely not a school-only report. It has words like campus in it that I think are very much school-specific. But, yeah, if I had my... I think everyone would see this. The difficult thing is sometimes when these things get reported, the only thing that gets reported are the negatives, or they get reported somewhat sensationally. And so I just appreciate when a school district takes the time to really look at the numbers, what they really are. And they're just numbers right now.
Frank, I think that was an excellent point about faculty and their role in this. We had a student disciplinary matter this evening in closed session, and we've had a number of them over the course of the years I've been on the board. And one thing I wanted to acknowledge is our teachers really stick their necks out and intervene at times, and it's really important, and I've always admired them for doing that.
Yeah.
My question is... has to do with Friday Night Live. This has been a program that's been sustained for quite a number of years. Do we have any data as to the impact of this as a particular program?
We do. We do. We have a good tool that is called the State Youth Development Survey. So we certainly know where our young people who engage in Friday Night Live stand in terms of their connection. Some of those asset pieces that I'm not addressing that are part of the Healthy Kids Survey, in terms of their connectedness to school, their feelings of participation and involvement, and we do track that on a regular basis. We have some older data that showed young people who were engaged in a program like FNL or FNL used X amount less than others. So those things do exist, too, but that's not part of this presentation. But we do track it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much. This was really informative.
On the record, that was really 6 minutes and 50 seconds for Chris Dowler. Just so everyone agrees, that was only 6 minutes and 50 seconds. Thank you.
We know Mr. Dowler is a man of few but powerful words.
And Kim's going to put up some slides for the Coastal Family Resource Center and our emerging SLO Family Resource Center. Taking a slightly different approach than I've used in the past and going for more just slides with titles and nice pictures, and then I'll just talk very briefly about the slides and some of the prompts that they give. Basically, while we start, yeah, there we go. what is the background for the Coastal Family Resource Center? Originally, this was a center developed by Terry Kurcheski with a child development center during the 2010-2011 school year at the old Sunnyside Elementary school site. And a counseling space has been essential in expanding counseling services dramatically. We've also been able to open additional space. What you see right there is a classroom space where we offer parenting classes, three different parenting classes, and we also have safe meetings once a month out there. We were also able to apply and be awarded a $5,000 grant from the Community Foundation to support needs of coastal families. And we also were able to coordinate 3 to 4 volunteers that rotate open doors from 9 to noon Tuesday through Thursday out there. So we were able to actually have open door hours for the community to be able to access services. Next slide. There's some specific facts and data. I mean, we use data a lot, but for another word, I'm able to just give you some very specific facts about what we were able to accomplish between January and June of this last school year. We had 52 families referred to the through our school counselors. We received 43 calls from families inquiring about services. We connected 27 unique families to counseling support. We were able to directly provide assistance for school materials, supplies, other basic needs to 18 families. We directly assisted 9 families with obtaining Medi-Cal or Healthy Families Insurance. We referred 6 families to a family advocate who is provided by Transitions Mental Health. And we were able to host a food bank distribution twice a month, serving up to 40 families each time. At each distribution, and we also host 3 parenting classes. I think they meet once a week with 10 parents participating roughly in each class. Next slide. We are about to open a family resource center here in San Luis Obispo. It's going to look slightly different, but we're opening, hopefully, our goal was the beginning of October, which is being pushed back a little bit to probably late October, in a space adjacent to the Community Action Partnership building. It's basically right there in the Capslo offices, which is a really large nonprofit service agency here in San Luis Obispo. We're going to be basically utilizing homeless grant funds to hire a full-time family advocate. We'll have an office at this location in addition to a host of other CAPSLO programs, a wide variety of programs in order to support families and students here in San Luis Coastal. And the services in this center will focus on family advocacy, linking families directly to services available throughout San Luis Obispo. I do think it's important to note that these centers are low to no cost centers, primarily through accessing partnerships with community agencies and being funded directly through grants. The focus in these family resource centers isn't just to provide social services for social service sake, but rather it's directly linked to student achievement. You know, trying to provide for basic needs of the families and students will help them attend and achieve better once they arrive at school. All right. Any questions?
You made reference to donations or the food bank or things like that. How are your donations? Where do you receive those? If there are people who wish to donate or have items to donate to this center,
that would be great.
How is that done?
Actually, primarily through grants, but if an individual would like to donate, they can contact myself or Melissa Musgrave.
Okay, thank you.
Do you know if they're going to resume the food bank distribution there at the coast?
Supposed to start up this month.
Great.
Yeah, I had anticipated it starting earlier, but I think this month, definitely.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Dallard, do we have bilingual capabilities at both locations?
The family advocate out at the coast is bilingual, bicultural, and our family advocate that we'll be hiring through CAPSLA will be bilingual, bicultural as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, is she bilingual?
Also Venice.
Okay. Good to know.
See. Jim's bilingual.
Yeah.
Chris, one of the phenomena that I've heard is happening is we're seeing more families that were doing fine and they were own their homes and didn't need help. And are we seeing within the, at least the one that's open out on the coast, are we seeing a change in clientele?
I don't have any data that would give any specific information about a change. My data is kind of a baseline data set, so I don't really, I can say anecdotally that that's definitely in line with what I'm hearing anecdotally, but being able to see that. You know, we do know that our homeless population has grown exponentially over the last, 3 to 5 years, hugely. I think at the end of last year we had identified about 60 students that were homeless at some point during the school year.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
We brainstormed. We talked about different ways that could happen, and I suggested that we bring a guest speaker to our community, someone that carries a message about community and bringing people together for what he refers to as the great conversation. So Terry borrowed the book from me, and she read his book, Schools Cannot Do It Alone. And we saw, as a board and as superintendent and team, we saw Jamie Vollmer present at the CSBA conference a couple years ago. And he's a lively fellow and certainly has a great understanding of American public education history. And so we have banded together with Teach on this event, and he will come out next Monday, October 8th. And he will present at a luncheon for essentially a smaller group in San Luis Obispo. And his message to that particular group will be, how to frame out that conversation and what is the conversation. And then there will be two presentations that later that day, one at 4 o'clock. We have reserved the theater in Downtown Cinemas in San Luis. And for the staff at 4 o'clock, for the employees here in San Luis Coastal, and the community at 7. And I just want to say that this could serve as a really nice catalyst for what I believe is important in public education right now, and that is that we need to do a better job of communicating with our community, whether it be the business community, the higher education community, or the seniors in our community, as well as the parents. This is what we're about. This is what we're trying to accomplish, that every child we invest in, every child we educate, indeed improves our community. And yesterday we spoke on the Dave Congleton Show, and we were given an hour there, and so we're excited to have him out, and so I just think this is the beginning of an important process over the next several years, where we reach out and open ourselves up to the conversation about the work that we do. I personally believe is so important to creating thriving communities.
Thank you very much. How's the registration going?
At this point, we have, I'm guessing, around 40 people coming to the luncheon. Dr. Stork from Cuesta, Dr. Crocker from the county office, Dr. Detweiler from School of Education, the dean of the School of Education from Cal Poly. They're attending. We have several members of the board. We have PTA leaders. We have, I believe, county supervisors coming, so city council members. So we're going to have a lively discussion. SLCTA President Paul Orton will be there, and CSEA representative will be there as well. So I think some of our principals will be there, and that's for the luncheon. And then in the 4 p.m. showing, it looks at this point we have about 40 to 50 at each the 4 and the 7 p.m. So it should be a nice show.
Thank you. Mark.
Thank you. I want to make sure that this is something that it's not just San Luis Coastal parents, it's not just San Luis Coastal staff, and it's just not San Luis Coastal residents. My understanding is that this is open to anybody from the county that would like to come if they get their reservations in.
The 4 p.m. is actually meant for San Luis Coastal staff. There's only 220 25 seats in the theater. Sure. So I think it's really important that our employees hear, because Mr. Vollmer is actually such a powerful advocate for what we do, for educators in general. Public education is his thing. And though he isn't quite well-versed in our own community, the point that I want to get across, and his message I believe carries well, is that we have to be willing to understand the added dimensions year after year after year for decades of unfunded mandates, additional things that we are expected as educators and governance boards to do. And the thing that hasn't changed in all of that time is the instructional day, the amount of time that we've given kids. So we're adding more and more and more, except for time. And yet the expectation through standardized testing is actually penalizing schools, and they're penalizing the kids that need more time. The model is pulled out from underneath us, and double that with a lack of understanding in our communities about what it is we're tasked with. So there's a whole lot in this. It won't be accomplished in one conversation, but that's his message, that we should at least begin the conversation and reach out to key core groups and say, do you know that this is what we do? And then be willing to hear back from them and be willing to answer their questions and at least provide some reasonable set of responses.
And I just want to mention that in his book, I think what he does, at least for me, is bring the focus in a broader focus. And he's not picking targets, you know, that this particular group or is the problem. If we just fix this, the whole system will run much more smoothly. He realizes that there's a number of issues, as you've mentioned, that need to be addressed, including the community's perception of what the school should or should not do. And so I think I would encourage any of my former colleagues, anybody in the community, to come here and speak, because I think it's informative. I think it's an eye-opening experience.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 7.05, review of elementary school population trends, open enrollment, and school capacity concerns. And that would be Mr. Robinette.
That sounds like a mouthful. As you know, we've been paying careful attention to district growth over the last several years, the last couple years in particular. From this day to this same day a year ago, we are up 137 students in the school district, so we are no longer a declining enrollment district. This is our second year, maybe our third year, of actually having some increases in enrollment. In most school districts, that brings revenue. That's exciting. You get more students, you get more money. In a basic aid district, it's kind of the opposite. We love having the students. We love having kids in our schools, but that 137 students equals $370,000 in added teacher costs to the school district. So when we have kids, we have the need to put teachers in front of them. As you know, we focused on open enrollment quite a bit, making sure that we are staffing properly our neighborhood schools and trying to control to the extent possible our open enrollment trends. We know we embrace open enrollment and school of choice in our school district, but especially with kindergarten enrollment, we've tried to kind of stabilize that, especially at some of our schools. This last year had lotteries at Pacheco, as we always have. This was the first year we had a lottery at Teach Elementary. We had a lottery for the Los Ranchos Transitional Kindergarten Program. What I want to show you is a few graphs that partially to set up what we're going to talk about a little bit later, sixth grade STEM, but also another real concern in the city as far as population growth. So I'm very aware of the whole Mark Twain adage, you know, there's three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics. So I want to be really careful not to skew things with the graphs too much to do anything but tell the truth. But I want to look at three of just to give you a snapshot of what's happened in some of our schools, in our elementary schools, because our secondary schools enrollments are, they go up and down, but they're a lot easier to kind of control, and we have space for those. At Baywood Elementary, and I want you to know on that left-hand axis, that horizontal axis, is only a 10-student differential. So don't take a huge amount of, I mean, you know, there's only 10-student difference between those lines there. But what you can see is from 2008-09 up to last year, we had steady growth at Baywood Elementary School. Baywood's one of our kind of smaller footprints as a campus in terms of where the students reside. And this last year, we had a significant decrease, which was really interesting to us. We moved two special education programs off that campus to Monarch Grove, which does not account for that many students. Those are small special ed programs. So it's an interesting phenomenon. We had less kindergarten students going to Baywood. We actually had more inter-district open enrollment transfers. I shouldn't call them intra-district. Open enrollment transfers, students from the Baywood attendance area requesting to go to Monarch Grove, when that other trend is, it's actually been the opposite in previous years. So that's an interesting trend we're seeing. If we were to project out about 3 years, and this is a crystal ball, this is not scientific, although I base my projections on the good work of Dr. Ed Valentine, who taught me everything he knows about this kind of stuff, and he's really good at that. Very good at projecting. We see Baywood growing a little bit again over the next few years, if we were to just pull it out about 3 years, growing to the point of about 420 students, which is 65. It's actually a larger campus than Baywood, which is, you know, looking at that 400 number. Is there a question, Mr. Unger? Okay. If you look at the next one, we can see another coastal school, Del Mar. Now, Del Mar, I actually have 20 differential on that horizontal axis. So this is a pretty severe growth rate. In fact, what I would argue is a kind of unsustainable growth rate. Del Mar has definitely increased its population in the last couple of years. If you look just at cohort data, the number of sixth graders leaving the school, kindergartners coming in, it's putting that school by 2015-16 at about 515 students. Now, that's a prediction. It may or may not happen, but that would definitely necessitate building out that school a little more, adding a couple portables to that school, or changing what happens with some of the after-school programs at that school. So the cost of a portable is about $160,000. So it's just one of those things we have to kind of pay attention to. And there's really no way to control the population in Morro Bay, because unless we want to open another school. And we probably don't want to open Morro L again, because it's the only outlet. We don't force families to go into Los Osos if there's no room at Del Mar. I mean, it's a Morro Bay school, and we let people stay in Morro Bay. So the Del Mar population is a pretty kind of severe trajectory right now. It's just growing. If you were to look at the city schools, and I don't have any of the city schools except one, it's really interesting because Los Ranchos, for example, is a school that was growing, and seems to have leveled off, and we can predict a nice leveling off there. Sinsheimer's kind of the opposite, shrinking, seems to be leveling off. So the boundary adjustment that was made there several years ago might start leveling out. Los Ranchos is a larger school than Sinsheimer, but it looks at least like those population trends will continue. C.L. Smith kind of goes up and down over the years. Hawthorne is steady. I mean, they have 350 kids a year, and we don't do anything about it. They just get that many kids every year. Pacheco, we control the growth. It's a lottery school. But Bishop's Peak and Teach is a unique issue. And if I can look at this next slide, this will have to kind of explain this one a little bit. As you're aware, for the last 12 years or so, Bishop's Peak and Teach occupy the same campus, two schools on the same campus. And when that began, Bishop's Peak was our smallest school. And so that made sense from a logistical standpoint, put two schools on one campus, on your smallest campus. Those green bars represent the Bishop's Peak population, and the orange bars represent the Teach population. So you can see a steady trajectory up until this year of now 520 students in both schools. 365 in Bishop's Peak and 155 in Teach Elementary. That's about as big as that place can get safely, without adding more portables, or without figuring out maybe some different traffic pattern. I mean, it's a big school. I mean, it's a lot of students for a fairly small, concise area of a school. If we were to project out 3 years and keep the teach population stable, which there's more people probably interested in going to that school, but if we kept it stable at 160 students, that'd be 32 students a class. You can see the Bishop's Peak population is still going to grow. And who knows why? I mean, one of the big speculations is that Cal Poly did a major initiative to get student housing on campus. A lot of the area around the Foothill corridor was rental property. We're speculating that's a lot of families living there now. And so Bishop's Peak just seems to be a school growing to be a normal, 450 student school, one of our larger elementary schools by itself. Teach Elementary is also wanting to grow. And so it presents a unique problem for us. And to help address the problem, at least, we have the principal of Bishop's Peak and the principal of Teach, Mr. Block, to kind of talk a little about that.
So in a couple years there, I think in 3 or 4 years, we're almost 180 kids more on the campus. The facilities at Bishop's Peak and Teach are pretty small. Those who've been up there, we have a small multi-purpose room, kind of a congested parking. You access Craig to JC. Pickup time right now is a bit nuts. We kind of have a we work with our parents, but as soon as they line up in our pickup area, they kind of back up onto JC, which is a challenge. And definitely staff, we're seeing the impact of 180 students. This last year was an interesting one. We ended the year in June with our projections, and we got our allotment of teachers. By the time Janet Crabb, the school secretary, and I closed the office in late June and opened up in a month later, the voicemails, the fax machine, we gained about 40 kids just in the time between. For that group of students, we'd like to be able to offer them a straight fifth grade, which would lower the class size, because in our Bishop's Peak, we're at 35, 34 right now in our class size. So that's one of the concerns that we have moving forward. It was a very stressful. We were nervous. Janet would come into my office after a family would come in, and we just crossed our fingers hoping that it was a grade level where we had space. Because where Bishop's Peak is located, we have Pacheco right down the street, but we're really the only neighborhood school on that side of campus. And in fact, our attendance area dips all the way up to this district office facility as well. So going forward, right now we have 530 students. I'm not sure exactly where that's going to go. But I have started the conversation at my school site about our issue. With two school sites on one campus, it's been 11 years they've shared a campus. It's my sixth year there, and this is the first year where we're really running out of space to operate both programs. I had a management team meeting with my staff yesterday, and we started talking about the issues and possible solutions. I have a staff meeting tomorrow. I have a school site council on Thursday, boosters for our Teach population on Friday, and next week a PTA where I'm going to introduce the topic and start getting community input, staff input, parent input about what we could do to solve the problem by looking at whether it's attendance, school facilities at our site within the district to see what we can do to solve that. And then later on in the month, I'll put a group together that has members of both groups that we put a forum together, and I can outreach to you guys as well, just to see what we have from the input of all these different groups, and we'll move forward. And I will give Dr. Prater kind of a report or what ideas have come forward as a part of this process.
Thank you. Questions from board members? Okay. Oh, Mrs. Sheffer.
I just have one question about just the population growth in general, and it may be Mr. Robinette who can answer this. How many much of our growth is due to students from other districts transferring in to our district?
Not a lot, unless we have people transferring into our district who have false addresses that we don't know about. I mean, we actually exit students from our school district to other districts largely through the Templeton Independent Study Program. We have a
kind of a blanket denial system for inter-district transfers unless they've already been in our school system. But even on transitional, you know, moving from one grade level or one school to another, we deny those transfers. So it seems like it's homegrown.
Okay.
We do suspect that with what's happening around us, with schools, you know, having gigantic class sizes compared to us. I mean, we have larger class sizes than we've had before, but they're still appreciably lower than our neighbors. That and with the amount of people who work in the city of San Luis Obispo, that we have people who are falsifying addresses coming to our schools. Bishop's Peak and Teach might be one of those schools. We certainly suspect that in the Morobay High School community. So, you know, that's something we haven't been super active in going after that issue, but we suspect that's happening to some degree.
Okay, but you believe that primarily it's the growth is occurring within our
seems
our
like it's home
boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Jim, and then Marilyn.
As to Teach, is a significant number of those students and that increase over the last couple of years, is that coming from the coast or is it more in town or?
Off the top of my head, I did an analysis a few years ago, but about a third are from the coast and about two-thirds from in town. And we do have a waiting list after the lottery for Teach, and we also this year denied, we could have had a lottery in the primary for Bishop's Peak, but we denied all the open enrollments and never had a lottery as our classes were full without that process.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Block, I'm wondering, did I hear you say that in your fourth grade you didn't have a straight four and you had 35 students in combination classes?
I think I'm about 33 in that combination. We have 34 in fifth grade and 35 in sixth grade. Those are straight classrooms. But even with adding a teacher, the kids have just kept coming. Even after school and we mailed out the assignments, we've continued to add students somewhat methodically over the last few weeks as well.
Of the students that you have at Teach Elementary, the two-thirds that come from town,
mm-hmm.
would you say that Bishop's Peak is your primary feeder?
Yes. Changing school sites to attend a school of choice at fourth grade is a big decision. It's easy when all you have to do is change hallways, and certainly I have the most access to that program. So, by far the biggest number come from Bishop's Peak.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for starting those conversations.
Thank you.
So I think you may have just answered this question, but is there a policy when a student gets accepted to or begins to attend Teach, is there a policy that the sibling can then start attending Bishop's Peak?
No, there is not. It's two different schools, which most people perceive it as one school. We say the name so fast, Bishop's Peak Teach, that when they came to Teach, many were disappointed because we did take siblings. The only kids that we did take in Bishop's Peak in the primary grades is if they had a sibling that attended Bishop's Peak currently attending. And that, for some students that applied as third graders, or they had a kindergartner student coming up, and then when they got into fourth grade at Teach,
to the educational context of cost and of program and aligning it to the board's initiatives and all of those things. There's also a lot of factors involved that I couldn't expect Dan to put together for you. So I will take it from him. He can certainly participate in the conversation as he should, but I would like to take his information, his data, and put it into a context that the board could then look at and see it in context.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that would help me with the context, I guess it's two things. One is where in our values are neighborhood schools, because that was a core principle for the school district for the 20-something years that I've been around. And then the other thing is, Teach has been around for a long time. I would really like to be updated on what the programmatic differences are between Bishop Peak and Teach. I kind of lost track of that, and I think it's important to the discussion about what we do.
And that's definitely part of the plan.
Thank you. And I think Mr. Millar's points are well taken. I'd like to second gathering that information. And then just be sure that I'm understanding correctly that Mr. Block, when he has this conversation, it will include not just parents. Who should I be looking at? Mr. Block. Not just parents, but, you know, the community members surrounding your school site who are impacted by the figures that we're seeing here, and also your certificated staff and your classified staff, your clerical people, your custodial people, and what have you, because they're all interacting on this small site that is becoming a tremendously impacted school site.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I just would like to, in some final thoughts. This is a complex problem, a complex challenge to resolve. What I am trying to do is I'm trying to get ahead of this and view it through proactively so that the board has a long runway to make a good decision, as opposed to me coming back to you because it's easier to avoid this challenge, because it's a popular, very popular campus. The two schools are very well connected in the community and positive and popular. But when I look at those projections, I absolutely know that I cannot come to you with recommendations at the last minute, and it's not fair to you to have to make such a rash and harsh decision a year from now when you can look at it more deliberatively and thoughtfully in the context of program, cost, and what we expect from all of our schools, what's the best for kids. And that's what I plan to provide you enough runway here to make a good decision.
Thank you. And not to walk past the fact that we have Mr. Block here, and so we have the opportunity to converse with him and talk about the ways in which he intends to be proactive in now having recognized that this is a growing area of concern, you know, how he intends to go forward. Let's not walk past the problem that we have on the coast, too, that we don't have those principles in front of us, but we do have some very real concerns about the growth in our elementary schools on the coast, and we're going to need to be looking at what we can do, ways that we may be able to alleviate the problems. I have a feeling that there may be some discussion later this evening about that, but in discussing Bishop's Peak Teach, they're not standing alone. The coast is definitely impacted as well.
That's correct. And I would like to publicly state this. And there's three big things in front of the board this year. One of those is obviously the budget. The other one will be the coast and how are we going to navigate program on the coast. And we will hear about that, a proposal this evening. And then Bishop's Peak Teach, the campus itself, looking at those projections, we will need to take that very seriously in order to make the best decision for our community.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to item number 8, which is a determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. This will be a public hearing.
Since then, we've become sufficient in all of those areas because we go quickly to order materials and get that, except for one, which we expect by the time we come back for the resolution, we will be sufficient. And that is fourth grade science, where we're still waiting on our order of materials to come in. But we very much expect that by the time of the resolution at the next board meeting, we will be sufficient in all areas as we are required to be legally.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll go ahead and open this public hearing. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board on this item? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing. Thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 9, the discussion of approval to initiate the program planning for a possible 6th grade STEAM pilot at Los Osos Middle School. Thanks, Carl.
Good evening, members of the board, Dr. Prater, Assistant Superintendent Mr. Miller, and Mr. Robinette. I want to thank you for the opportunity for being here tonight. At the conclusion of our last discussion about the transition or possible transition of 6th grade to Los Osos Middle School, staff, myself, and my colleague, Mr. Bloom, and my teaching staff was asked to put some meat on the bones a little bit on the idea and around this idea. And that's what we've provided for you tonight in a brochure format. Before we review the materials, though, tonight, I wanted to clarify one thing about this proposal, that we are talking about different ways to teach our sixth graders and not a better way. I think it's important for us to acknowledge that in our current elementary schools, our sixth grade teachers, those sites are doing an excellent job with our kids and have done so for many, many years. So this is not a discussion about what's better. This is a discussion about differences. And we are excited about some of those differences, and we'd like to share some of those differences tonight. We do feel strongly that adolescents have changed, and through this different opportunity, we can address some of those changes of adolescents. If you go to the brochure and you open it to the very first page, the category, what I've attempted to do, or what we've attempted to do, is categorize some of these topics and ideas for you in a way that's easy to follow. And I wanted to start with the academic support for success for all students. And that's on the right side of your brochure. And I wanted to carry you through some of these ideas of how we see it being different at Los Osos Middle School. Of course, this addresses Initiative 6, which is creating an accelerated and specialized learning opportunity for students. One of the roadblocks that we see for our kids as they transition to middle school, as you can probably imagine, and I've used an analogy with many folks many times, we have students who come from sixth grade classroom and they have a self-contained one system, one teacher, one set of expectations. And when they arrive with us at the middle school, all of a sudden they have 6 sets of expectations. And that causes an organizational roadblock for some of our students. And so one of the positives around having 6th grade at our site is how to address that system of organization. So the transition from one teacher in elementary school to 3 or 4 in 6th grade, with a final bridge to 6th graders in 7th and 8th grade, we do see our 6th grade 6th graders maintaining a core class, but then being able to push out on campus to see a science teacher and possibly take advantage of some advanced math opportunities with a math teacher as well. So it reduces the amount of contacts they have with different individuals, different expectations. And then when they move into 7th grade and they have those 6 teachers, they have a taste of it before they live that experience in the 7th and 8th grade. Again, to address the greater access to acceleration and remediation for learning students, we see that as another opportunity that we provide that's different than elementary schools, and that's in the area of a science, math, an elective wheel that we'll talk about in just a moment. In the middle of your brochure that you can see, we also have the opportunity through this potential change to create a very dynamic and interesting STEAM wheel elective for our 6th graders. We've also put some meat on that bone for you a little bit and flushed out that our 6th grade teachers, core teachers, would all be charged with teaching a 6-week course, a core course, around a project-based learning theme, and we've given you some possible course titles. And as you read through those course titles, you'll notice that each of them addresses part of the science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics component, which is what STEAM, an individual science class, which I think is something that is very important for those 6th grade students to experience, and I think will be a robust experience for them from what they're experiencing now. PE will stay with their core teachers. They won't dress out. We'll talk about that a little bit later, too, as a common question of parents. And then period five and period six. Period five will be in with either with their math at grade level, sixth grade math course. But many sixth grade students may be ready for an advanced level math class. And being on our campus, we would strategically schedule so that those students could then push out at the same time to a pre-algebra, algebra, or even geometry class, which we do offer at our site. So there's an accelerated opportunity for those students. And then at the end of the day, which we've structured our school this year, and it's been working very well, would be that STEAM wheel experience for our kids. So our sixth graders would then take part in that series of courses, all rotating through and experiencing each one of those courses as they travel through their day. Another opportunity for LOMS to provide support and success for our students is in the area of social and emotional support, which addresses Initiative 2, which is creating an intentional culture of care, and that's in the very first part of your brochure. And there are some really interesting data that support the fact that physical changes among our youth, and trust me, I'm living this right now in my own home with my 11-year-old daughter, are happening in an earlier age than ever before. So as we might have thought 25 years ago, when those changes were happening for adolescents at 12 to 14, we're now seeing those changes happen for these kids at 10 to 11 years old. And so they are feeling like, in so many ways, both physically and emotionally, like their secondary peers, more than, say, a kindergartner or third grader. So that's one of the adolescent changes we see. Young adolescents can benefit from a diverse and comprehensive counseling program to support their needs. And at Los Osos, we will provide an academic counselor, as well as three other social and emotional support counselors. That's our SAP program that Mr. Warren mentioned earlier today. So those services are on our site. We also feel strongly that 3 years of positive school bonds instead of the 6-2-4 model, the 5-3-4 model creates a greater connection for students. So they spend more time with us at our site, spend more time with their peers, with their teachers, with our program, creating a school bond for us. We hear that a lot from students, that they kind of come and go so fast through our school. And having them spend a little extra time with us creates a better bond. And also this concept that I think was not as unique to this transitional experiment or experience for these sixth graders is that they're all coming to us. This is not a choice. And it addresses some of Mr. Millar mentioned earlier about the neighborhood schools being so important. You know, critical to this transition is the fact that all the friends, all the connections, all the community connections, the parent connections are all coming together. So all of them will join us. And we're excited about that as well, that opportunity. With your support of Wi-Fi implementation at our site at LOMS, and we see the wires up and running, and it's exciting. We are poised to complete that project very soon. It is primed us to take our students into experiencing the 21st century classroom of the future. And on the back side of your brochure, you'll notice that under the section of 21st century classroom, addressing Initiative 8, the classroom of the future, part of the sixth grade program will be provide an individual device, an iPad, a notebook, a netbook for all sixth graders to interact with daily as a learning tool. We see that, and I'll have Mr. Robinette expand on this topic a little later. We see that as a $500 cost incurrence to us and a $100,000 technology allocation for year one, which I know that Mr. Robinette will also expand on a little bit. We also are excited about the opportunity to hire or bring on board, which we do see as many internal candidates, people with this specific skill set. So as we move to this program, asking those current employees that are excited about the STEM and STEAM opportunity and joining our program and our team, that is a crucial skill set, which is that technology skill set. Emotional safety, security, and the opportunity to grow on our sixth graders is extremely important to all of us. We felt that it was important to address some of the concerns or possible concerns of the sixth grade parents. So we just very clearly for you wanted to put some of the answers to those questions on the back. And in the middle of the back of this program, you'll notice that we included answers to frequent questions of sixth grade parents. I guess I could have created a top 10 list maybe, but I'm at Los Osos Middle School where our dances are very popular. We have a dance component at our school site, but we also have the gym open with foosball and Guitar Hero and all kinds of things happening for kids who just aren't ready or interested in the dance component of middle school. And it's about half and half. And so I feel it's a real positive night. They can choose to be where they want to be during the evening. We will have hooks and core classrooms for backpacks, not lockers. Believe it or not, that's a fear of every seventh grader coming in. You know, can I get my locker open? But we plan to maintain a core elementary classroom environment where kids come in, their backpacks are in their classrooms, and that is their headquarters, their core classroom. We have a sixth grade community of classrooms that exist at Loam's. We have eight portables that are offset on our campus that serve as a not separate, but separate enough to be their own community, and it's a very nice environment. We will have sixth grade camp, which we do see continuing. I know that's a very important capstone activity for many sixth graders, and we've already had a plethora of ideas on how we can continue to do that for those sixth graders. And also, you know, we will provide those elementary recess type activities. You know, we plan to do the small things like having Foursquare available and adding those elements to our campus that allow those kids that still enjoy those traditional elementary fun activities to take part. And having been an elementary principal, I'm very, very keen and aware to those types of needs of those kids. So we will have those activities available for them as well. Feedback and collaboration with our new sixth grade parents and students is going to be critical in this process. And communication opportunities are the capstone of our timeline for parents. We've included that in our handout. The goal for myself, my colleague, Assistant Principal Mr. Bloom, staff members, is to, in the month of October, you'll see the timeline there. I'm not going to read it to you, but I think the most important part of that timeline will be in the month of October, given your blessing tonight, will be to visit and have scheduled nights through contacts with PTA at each of the coastal elementary schools. Also have a night at our own site to solicit questions and receive feedback from parents and answer questions that we can answer. Let them visit the school. Just basically have an open and honest conversation with potential parents who want to hear about what the ideas about the program are. We intend to invite all parents to every meeting. So we don't intend to have a Baywood meeting, and if you missed it, you missed it. We will call it a series of meetings that we hope to allow each parent to come to one or multiple meetings if they choose. But our interest is to communicate, to make them feel comfortable with us, to make them feel comfortable with Los Osos Middle School. And that's why we'll also really push to have them come join us on our open house in April as well. We already get that from our potential parents coming to seventh grade, but we'll encourage them to come and join us and meet the teachers and just get a sense of how positive it is at Los Osos Middle School. At this time, I wanted to allow Mr. Robinette to kind of give you some budget implications or projected budget implications. We know that's a logical question you will have. And then I am here, obviously, as well as my assistant principal, Mr. Bloom, to answer any questions you might have at this time.
And we have other members of the Los Osos community out there, I see.
We do.
Yeah. I think what's important, at least from my perspective, having been involved in initiating a sixth grade program at a middle school before, is what you this brochure is a roadmap. It's not necessarily the territory.
Absolutely.
I think when you start getting parent input, when you start talking to staff, when you start getting closer to, is this something we're ready to do? Is this something the board can embrace? There may be schedule changes in what's necessary to accomplish there, but nice job. In thinking about the budget, I think it's important to realize that there shouldn't be personnel costs associated with the move. I mean, the staffing ratio at the sixth grade level in the elementary school is pretty much the way a staffing ratio works with a preparation period if we treat sixth grade teachers at the middle school like we would any secondary middle school teacher. It's pretty much a wash. So we expect, if this was all the students from Monarch Grove, Baywood, and Del Mar, it's 155 students, something like that, coming over to the school, the staffing ratio. So personnel costs, it would just depend, are we getting more students than we expect or less students than we expect? But, you know, those fluctuate with any enrollment trends. But we do realize that to start a program that of a larger magnitude, bringing that many students over to a school, we can't just say, yeah, it's not going to cost anything. It's a no-cost issue. So in thinking about it, we are going to have a committee of people planning it made up. I think we do a makeup in this. I have $35,000 to do some of that refurbishing, repaint the four square courts and those kinds of things. Furniture equipment, $15,000 to $20,000, maybe some other miscellaneous $15,000 to $20,000. I'm coming up with about $180,000. Startup costs to do the program. So I think that's just important for the board to realize. Now, to sustain that program over years, you know, with that technology piece, a three-year period, we may be looking at about $450,000 over 3 years, assuming we continue bringing sixth graders in, they continue to have a device, we develop this program. So it's not without cost. I mean, you know, over a three-year period, about a $450,000 estimate. Now, the cost of a portable classroom is about $160,000. So, you know, we're weighing partially the idea of expanding classrooms at Del Mar or Baywood in order to add programs, probably one or two portables over the next 2 years, to the cost of just shifting the sixth grade. So that's just one way of looking at it. I know there's many considerations, and that's a very rough budget estimate. I think as they develop the program, we'll be able to get much tighter numbers for you.
First, there are a couple other people here that are at the meeting this evening that I would like to recognize by name.
Sure.
First, Jan Neiswanger, who's the secretary at Los Osos Middle School. We welcome you. And Didi Narcisia. Yeah.
Didi Narcisia.
We want to
yes.
welcome you, and I think it's great that you're showing your support. And then an old friend of ours, Phil Angel, is here. Thank you, Phil, for coming.
He does an excellent job for us teaching social studies, Mr.
Yeah.
Angel.
And so it's just nice to see the Los Osos Middle School community is coming out to the meeting as well.
Absolutely.
So from there, I'll take it to the board for questions. I think, Marilyn, you had a question first, and then
was I first?
Yes,
okay.
You were. And then Ellen.
A couple of questions. The $90,000 on the technology piece for the actual little notebooks or whatever, is it anticipated that then if a child got a notebook in the sixth grade, they would take that on with them?
Not necessarily. Or, I mean, I think that we'd have to develop that. I think the idea would be that they would, that if we expanded this in seventh grade and then eighth grade, we would probably need to be adding more technology along the way. But, you know, we'll have to figure that one out.
Okay. And then, I love this brochure. Thank you so much.
Well, I can thank my colleague, Mr. Bloom. We were thinking about a format, and he's wonderful with that. So, yeah.
It's easy to understand. It can't be just for us. It will be easy for parents to understand. Beautifully laid out and very simple. I love the idea of going to visit a true middle school, and I would be an advocate for when the time for that visit comes, you know, taking maybe two elected parents from each elementary school, sixth grade parents. I know we can't take all of the sixth grade parents that would have concerns or questions, but representatives from each school so that they can have the viewing as well and bring back and disseminate some information to their parent groups. And I think this is exciting. I'm interested to see where our investigation takes us.
Yeah, I did want to reiterate, Mr. Robinette made a very good point that providing this to you, I had mixed feelings because I want this to be a product of feedback, and it seems like it's the cart in front of the horse, meaning that we haven't talked to our parents, our sixth grade parents, our community about their concerns. So we're projecting what we'd like to see. We're projecting some of those concerns, but I am excited, interested, intrigued by what we will hear from our parents about the prospects of this. We've already heard a little bit about it. You know, obviously, the concept gets out amongst the parents. They'll catch you out doing bus duty, and they'll want to talk about it. But it's been positive, you know, the idea about this idea. So,
thank you.
I have a few questions. Couple are programmatic, and some are logistic. You indicated that if a sixth grader comes in and could take seventh grade math,
right?
So what happens in seventh grade? That student takes eighth grade math, and then what happens in eighth grade?
Correct. So we've had one of the parts of this projected planning idea is initial conversations will begin with both high school principals, because this concept of STEAM, STEAM electives, STEAM opportunities is a district initiative, and we need to have that articulated connection with our high schools. So that is a lot.
The sixth graders go and visit. Will you head to the middle school? Will you initiate if this is going to occur in the 2013-14 school year, you'll have the fifth graders come and
Absolutely.
Pay a visit to their new site.
Absolutely.
And just push
I
that
foresee
down
maintaining the same time. It's a wonderful program. We have the sixth graders visit.
Sure.
It's so neat to see them come off the buses being a new principal at Los Angeles Middle School. That was a new experience for me. And they come off with a slight smile, and they leave us just chatting it up and talking and feeling so comfortable. It's a neat thing. So, yes, we would transition any type of capstone activity at the elementary schools, which would then be a fifth-grade capstone activity to come and see us at the middle school. Absolutely.
And then I'll be curious to see if we have feedback indicating that the San Luis in-town schools want to explore this same
mm-hmm.
concept. And just on a final comment, I would say that one of the positive things I see about this thing you were talking about, you discussed the students feeling more connected with a greater period of time. I think the level of parent involvement and connection
Yes.
will increase greatly by knowing that their student will be at a site for 3 years rather than the 1 year thinking, you know, just you're on your way in, then you're on your way out. There's not that level of connection that I have noticed and experienced at the elementary level and the high school level, and I think
and we're excited to capture that energy, the PTSA energy that happens in the elementary schools,
right.
and continue it. We've been lucky to have some key players. Patty Reveille is one on the coast who has kids in all the schools, so she has really driven the energy at our middle school. But to capture that sixth grade energy with the parents and continue that parent involvement
right.
through the middle school experience.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for the presentation.
Sure.
It would be interesting to follow this along.
Yes.
Mark, Catherine, and Walter.
Thank you. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Mark.
I think I think the comments have been great. And I'm just crossing off my questions as I go. So thank you. The question was asked about carrying their books or mm-hmm. whatever their electronic device through the system. So can you explain to me or help me understand how the STEAM program will work with 7th and 8th graders? Are they going to participate, or are we starting 6th graders and then just moving it through over a three-year period?
Right. So we will start it with the 6th grade. So the 7th and 8th grade experience is kind of a grandfathering situation, if you want to look at it that way. I think the initial costs of the upstart would be in the 6th grade program to bring in. I see it on multiple levels. I see that core group of teachers implementing that STEAM wheel program, but also providing professional development for our existing staff throughout that first year on their successes, their challenges with devices. I've created a couple of pilot documents already at my site around devices, potential what you could use in your class expectations around the appropriate use of those devices. We are running a pilot right now, an iPad pilot, in our sheltered EL classes at my site with iPads. So those kids currently are sitting at home with iPads that we've provided them. with full connectivity, 3G connectivity. So we're experiencing that for the first time. I applaud our IT department for looking into to how much insurance costs to do that for kids. And we have models that exist out there that address this type of idea, too, of how you function and how you provide it. You know, one of the analogies I've used with staff, and I don't know if it'll help all of you. If it doesn't, I apologize. But knowing the cost of textbooks these days, I don't know, Rita might be cringing behind me. I'm not going to turn and look. But the analogy I use is if you were to have a student walking on a rainy day and they had a textbook in their right hand and a Kindle in their left hand, you would prefer them to drop the textbook in the Kindle in the puddle, because it's actually less expensive to replace the Kindle than it is to replace the textbook. Mm-hmm. That's where we are. So when we look at the cost of technology and where we're going and how these kids learn, the capabilities of that device are so incredible, and the cost replacement once we get past that is really something that's very, very manageable, and there are many, many models that we could explore as a group to make this work.
Okay, just real quickly, I think this may be for Russell, in our budget last year, we had money set aside for this installation of Wi-Fi, am I right? So
it's in.
Okay, so part of this is not going to be on top of the upcoming budget.
Well, this amount has already been allocated by the board in this year's budget, and we've spent a considerable part of it, and by Christmas we should have a complete system installed at Los Osos Middle School, minus a few classrooms.
You're still offering the video production class at Los Osos?
Yes, we are.
Wonderful. My thought is that wouldn't it be great if a couple of your students could come along with you to San Mateo and make a video of that experience and then take it back and be able to share it at the sixth grade level and with the parents and burn DVDs and
fabulous,
you know, make,
idea.
Yeah, bring that alive for everyone, because that's what you're going to be doing over there, isn't it? And my other question has to do with sports in Los Osos and Morro Bay, because I don't understand how this works a little bit. I know there's the Estero Sports League.
Right.
So those students all pretty much know each other already anyway. The sixth graders at Los Osos and the sixth graders in Morro Bay are probably friends or competitors. So they're also very, very familiar with each other. So I'm thinking that one of the things that we heard a lot about when we went to the board meeting, the meetings of the at Cayucas, about the interest in continuing those bonds with those students, is that I think if we ask the students, they will already have an interest in going to school with those friends in Los Osos and Morro Bay, and your idea of creating a community of sixth graders in those classes and those portals will be very attractive to them. So I'm hoping that we have an opportunity to survey the students as well as the parents, so we get feedback from the fifth graders now, who will be sixth graders next
year.
Yes,
and part of those evenings, you know, will be parent and student forums, and we will definitely encourage. We want to hear from the kids about the things that they're excited about. You know, Carl and I are always amazed when kids speak at student school site council meetings, even in the seventh grade. They're so telling the things that they will offer to us about what's really happening on a campus, their perceptions, their needs, their wants, where they feel safe, where maybe they don't feel so safe, and we're always interested in hearing what they have to say. And again, this would be an interesting transition, and like I said, I'll love to hear it from our kids that will be coming to my school, and then I've been asking questions of my own daughter at home, who's in sixth grade in Templeton, so it's been wonderful to hear from her about her fears and experiences and all the positive things that are happening with her, so it's good.
Excellent job.
Kyle, I thought the brochure was very helpful. I do understand your sensitivity to that, but it was the most important thing that you said was that we're not actually inventing how to educate sixth graders. We already do a pretty good job at that.
Absolutely.
It's more how to accommodate this into the 6-7-8 model. And I never got over Robinette fever the first time we did this. So I'm very excited about it, very enthused.
Well, and you know, on a serious note, I don't even think I've shared this with my colleagues. I'm kind of sticking my neck out here. But, you know, a lot of people have talked to me about the first experience, and I have to say that although I was not present for the first experience, I almost want to thank Rick for whatever happened during the first experience, because we learned so much from the first experience about responses, community responses, potential parent responses, things to look for, things not to look for. And so it's been, that has been a wonderful resource to be able to talk to Rick and say, hey, Rick, what do you think about? And he said, let's keep that in place. Or, hey, think about this or that. So that is also encouraging that we have that historical experience in place. Yeah.
Well, Kyle, I guess you probably want to move to Los Osos now, move out of Templeton, as I did, and get your daughter down to Los Osos Middle School.
So yeah, well, I've got a fourth grader, so and don't think I haven't thought about
that. Well, don't think about Bishop Peak Teach.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
that said,
I won't make that call.
I'm as a Los Osos parent and a person whose wife teaches at Del Mar, I'm very excited about this. I think it's going to be really good for the kids on the coast. This is a tremendous opportunity for us to move forward, and it's a tremendous opportunity for us to move our kids forward in our school district. Dr. Prater, are you looking for a motion on this? Mrs. Holmes is saying yes. I'm going to go ahead and approve the initiation of a pilot program for a possible sixth grade STEAM pilot program at Los Osos Middle School.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address this item? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to bring it back to the board. Is there any further discussion from the board? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Thank you very much.
And we thank you. We're very, very excited.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to poll the board right now. Is there anybody that would like to take a five-minute break?
No.
Okay. I'm getting a majority saying they want a five-minute break.
All right.
Okay. We'll take a five-minute break, and then we'll come back
to
item number 9.02.
I think Mrs. Holmes will put it up on the screen. This is a second reading from leftover from last meeting on the non-discrimination harassment board policy. The board requested that we provide a couple different versions because there seemed to be some weren't settled on the language in the last part of this policy. So, Mrs. Holmes, if you can put it to the second page or the end of this, you'll see two versions that I provided here based on the board feedback. There you go. So I put them in boxes there. Version one is what was recommended by CSBA, which is any student who feels that he or she is being harassed or harassed should immediately contact either the non-discrimination coordinator, which is our personnel director, or the principal or designee. One of the suggestions was, in keeping with Assembly Bill 9, shouldn't this be any staff member? Shouldn't somebody be able to report to anybody if they feel they're being harassed? And so Version 2 just has that language, either the coordinator for non-discrimination or a staff member. I suppose there are pros and cons to either version. Would a staff member necessarily know what to do if they got this? Is, I think, one of the concerns. And so if you chose to choose version 2, I think we would need to make sure that our administrative regulations and our practices were to make sure that all staff members know what they're supposed to do with such a report. And we can certainly do that. So either version, I'm sure we can adapt our administrative regulations to take care of it. The second suggested addition had to do with the last sentence in that second section. It was suggested that we should add language that was in our sexual discrimination policy. And so the last sentence reads, when the coordinator for non-discrimination, superintendent, or designee has determined that non-discrimination harassment has occurred, he, she shall take prompt appropriate action, and here's the important part, and address its effects on the victim. That's language lifted from the sexual harassment policy. So those are the two suggestions I heard, and I leave it to the board to discuss, and if you so desire, choose one.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board on this item? And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board for discussion. Dr. Eisenrath-Rogers.
I would just like to say I prefer two. I would prefer two, just because I think it's readily clear that you can go to anyone and you don't have to search somebody out, and then adding the language to the AR, that would be my preference. But I have one little thing I wanted to mention. I hate to do this to you because I know you've made all these edits, but if you roll back up a bit to where it gives the whole list of things that you can do that would be bullying, it seems to me as though we need an and or.
Oh, thank you.
Let me find that here.
Maybe a little bit up. A
little bit more up, yes. So there's this list of all the things one can do. No, not one can do, but all the various reasons you could be discriminated or bullied. And at the very end, there's an action. Right there, yes. It seems to me as though we need an or,
and
so that
each
of those actions, yeah, or individuals.
We can do that.
Thank you.
Well, both versions of the suggested change, I guess part of the problem I have with this is, well, I write warnings and instruction manuals for the marine industry for a living. And the language is directed toward the student. The student's not going to see this. This is an organizational document to tell our folks to draft your administrative regulations in a way to encompass these policy requirements. So Mickey Mousing around with language, I'm sorry. That was a poor choice of words, and I apologize. Changing language so that we are directing a message toward somebody who's not likely to be reading board policy is kind of a waste of time. So I'm satisfied with the way it was presented, without the version one or two.
Mark?
First of all, I appreciate your putting in the extra time and effort and capturing the thoughts that the board had at the last meeting. On the first one, I also prefer the version 2. Kim, I don't know if we can get back there. And the reason I don't think it's going to be that difficult for staff is because staff's already trained to be mandated reporters and are very aware of a process for reporting. Not that this is now included in a mandated report, but it's something they do and something they're trained in. I think, in fact, is it mandatory training that they get in their university, or do they get it when they get here?
Mandated reporting is something, yeah, that we go over with all employees when they're hired, and
okay.
It's part of annual notification.
Of the second revision.
I'm going to wade in with a little something here myself. Would it make I like number two myself, but would it make number two clearer to add, or a staff member who shall report it to the principal or a designee? Or is that too prescriptive and should be part of a board, part of an administrative regulation?
No, I think that's fine.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Well, I'm going to share my concerns about version two, and it's again probably reiterating something I said last week. And one is the training for staff to recognize harassment when they see it, and as opposed to, let's say, kidding or what have you. And then the other one is, now even though it's not mandated reporting, is this now raising this to that level? And so those are the two concerns I have with the version 2.
Yeah.
I think it might put an additional burden on staff who, like I said, may or may not recognize what constitutes bullying.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing you bring up. And we will obviously live with either choice and write ARs accordingly. Assembly Bill, this, we did a whole bullying policy, which the board adopted several meetings ago or a couple meetings ago. We just want to make sure we're covering all our policies that have any mention of this to make sure we're blanketing this. But Assembly Bill 9, to be editorialized a little bit, is like a lot of laws. It was written, it was passed, it's now mandated law in July. with a lot of unclarity or lack of clarity on what it means. When it says, now all staff members have to intervene when they see bullying. What does that mean? You know, what is the definition of bullying? And we can look and there is, you know, we can operationalize that to a certain degree, but we do have to now figure out, okay, how are we going to train all of our staff? How are we going to recognize the fine lines between bullying and something else? And so I don't know how we're going to do all that yet. We're just trying to make sure we have policy that's consistent with law, knowing that we have to do some work on that. So this one is the non-discrimination harassment. It's usually affected more with people who complain about a discrimination claim, and those usually get handled at an administrative level as opposed to somebody intervening on something they see. But we mentioned bullying in this. I mean, CSBA recommended putting bullying into this policy as well, just to make sure we're covering all of our bases. I don't know the answer to your question, but I right now, there certainly isn't any case law yet about whether or not some faculty member or employee is going to get in trouble if they don't intervene in something that's bullying per law, whereas it's very clear on case law about mandated reporting of child abuse that's very clear and made clear to employees. So I don't know where this falls in that. I'm not helping.
Okay, I'm gonna throw this proposal back out there, or version one with either the non-discrimination coordinator, the principal or designee, or a staff member. Would that work for me? But I don't know if that would work for other board members. And Jim, does that answer your concern about?
Does that, yes. To add back in the principal or designee.
Okay, so. I tell you what, I'm going to make a motion that we accept version one with the change in language so that it reads, any student who feels that he or she is being harassed should immediately contact either the non-discrimination coordinator, comma, the principal or designee, comma, or a staff member. And so, is there a second to my motion?
Yeah, I'll second that motion.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I'm sorry, Chris. We're voting on version one and two. Are we also at voting on suggested addition on also addresses
yes,
defects?
Yes, I would add. Yes.
Okay, then I'll second the motion.
What I'm hearing then is that you're asking to approve the policy revisions with the statements that you're making.
Yes.
So this is the only motion you'll need to make.
Yes.
And that includes the and or per Dr. Eisenrath Rogers' suggestion.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Mrs. Roger?
I could go with either version. It really doesn't handbook that it should be simple and clear so that it can be understood by parents and explained to their kids. And I think parents have to sign off on that handbook, and we hope that they read it, but we don't know if they really do. But just simple and clear in that aspect so that a child will understand that there is somebody to go to.
Mr. Buckman?
Oh.
Okay, is there any further discussion from the board? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. Mrs. Holmes?
I'm trying to bring up the actual board documents so that
maybe see. Okay.
Principal or designee or staff members.
Thank you. Okay, so we're voting on the version one as amended.
Okay. I'm sorry. My understanding is
Let me ask this question. Are we voting on version one as amended, including the suggested addition and the and/or?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
No.
Carries 5-2.
Can I make a brief statement?
Sure.
Okay. It's my belief, and I really want to thank the staff and the board for the steps they've taken on adding bullying to so many of the board policies. There's a reason that there's a national focus on this right now, and the reason is because there's just clear evidence that the effect of bullying on school and the ability to teach, and the effect on the effect on bullying and violence in the schools. And I'm glad to be a member of this board.
Thank you. Let's move on to item number 9.03, discussion of the County Committee on School District Organization. So this is a report on the Cayucas petition for territory transfer. Mr. Robinette?
Yeah, I just want to make sure the board is up to date on what's happening, since we have some imminent decisions that are going to be made affecting the potential ability for a vote on the transfer of territory for the Cayucas community. The report was issued to the county committee on September 19th, so a couple weeks ago. And the report details the criteria that are used to determine for the county committee to consider when determining whether or not a petition for a territory transfer is they're able to grant it. There are 9 criteria, and in the report that was issued, there were 3 areas that were identified in the report where it was indicated that the criteria was not met. In other words, in the report, it indicated that the criteria for the petition was not met for there to be a territory transfer. Those areas were criteria number 6, which had to do with whether or not this would have a significant disruption to any programs, and it was determined in the report that the Coast School District, Coast Union High School in particular, would be negatively impacted by the loss of the money, and so it would have an effect on their programs. Criteria 7 had to do with whether school facility costs, whether there was any significance in the facility costs that would have to do with this transfer. Part of the transfer, of course, is the annexation of the Cayucas territory into San Luis Coastal, if it were to go through. And there is an outstanding bond in about $14.5 million. That burden currently is shared between the communities of Cambria and Cayucas. And so with that annexation, the amount of money to be paid back on that bond, and Russell can correct me if I'm not explaining this well, the indebtedness would increase from approximately, unless it's on appeal. If they allow it to go to a vote, the second issue in front of that committee is who are the voters? Are the voters the citizens of Cayucas, or is it Cayucas in the Cambria area? Is it all 3 school districts? Is there some sort of territory that are carved out for that election? I wanted to remind the board that in a letter that was included in the packet, the board, based on the June 27th meeting, had stated these things, that you're going to support the county committee's efforts to provide a fair recommendation, that you're continuing to support our current practices regarding interdistrict transfers, which is to deny new interdistrict transfers but hold our own appeal hearing, consider them fairly, and hope that the county upholds those. And then lastly, that you would like to see a process developed that reflects a fair and equitable way to compensate us for the Cayuga students who attend our schools. They, meaning you, the board, would be interested in reviewing this process before any formal agreements are made, and you would like to wait until the county committee has formally made a recommendation prior to taking action. So I'm basically here tonight to make sure that that's still the course.
the report's been issued on October 9th, 10th, next Wednesday, October 10th. They will be making that decision, and we may very well want to entertain some sort of a dialogue with Cambria about revenue sharing or having money for students, but the board action is to wait and see what happens, entertain some kind of thing to see if there's some way to compensate, but to wait until the county committee has formally made a recommendation.
Rick,
so my question is, that is that the course?
I'm not sure I heard you right. So on October 10th, what happens on October 10th?
They will make a decision on whether to grant the petition or not.
Okay. Go ahead.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board? Okay, seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Is there, I guess the question really for board members, is there anybody who feels that the decisions we made on June 27th should at this time be changed?
Well, I'd like to ask a few questions.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Millar. Of course, yeah.
So, just between us, is there a significant opportunity to negotiate a good outcome prior to the committee making its decision? Anybody?
Well, there's always a chance to negotiate different aspects of any agreement that would maybe be thought of, and we've reached out to Cambria to try and have a conversation, but we've been unsuccessful in getting together up to this point.
He's been busy, I hear.
Pardon?
He's been busy, I hear.
Very busy. Yeah. Very busy. So busy you can't take a two-second phone call. But anyway, that's a different story. I think that the issue for us is a multitude of potential points to be discussed, and it would be about some sort of a transfer of the student fee, if you will, that's earned from that property tax. There would also be an opportunity for us to perhaps talk about the property tax effect and how that could be mitigated if the territory comes into our district. Is there a sense of our ownership or not? And this is something for the board to weigh in on mostly. But it's a topic of discussion to see. And then, of course, we have an interest in who gets to vote. And ultimately, that's a significant issue. I don't know personally, and I don't think any of us really know how the committee is going to react and what their recommendation is going to be. But Wednesday is going to be a watershed moment in terms of the future of this issue. So after Wednesday, there will be some clarity. If the committee agrees to honor the petition and move it into a vote, I think then all of a sudden we might have that conversation with Cambria that we're asking for. I think that if they deny that, then there's going to be some movement on Cayucas' part to renew that petition again and again and again. They'll do that. They already have made the commitment to continue their process over and over and over again because there's no limit.
And this is the parent group.
This is the parent group,
that is
correct.
Really, lest we forget, it's the parent group that initiated this whole process.
Right. And so I think waiting and being patient until Wednesday is a proper course of action.
Okay.
I think it was good for us to reach out and maybe eliminate the need for an election or even eliminate the need for a ruling on the petition. But we can't unilaterally do anything.
Yeah. I've learned over the years that it's a lot easier to negotiate a settlement before the verdict comes back than there is after. However, if the other side won't sit down, there's not really much you can do about it. But
there you
go.
Wait.
So, thank you, Russell.
Do you have information on where and when the county committee will meet?
It was from the work of Cayucas families, and I appreciate their dedication to pursuing this.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on then to item number 9.04, ratification of new teacher evaluation system and raise to SLCTA. Mr. Robinette, you're on again.
Yeah,
Mr. Pinkerton.
I'm going to earn my money tonight,
Mr.
Right?
Pinkerton,
you know?
Do something tonight.
He's been talking
here.
A lot. It's been good. Well, listen, it was this time last year that we negotiated an agreement with our teachers union to hopefully build a new evaluation system. And that was tied to an increase in pay, should we come to an acceptance of that. And so we started a thorough process last year at this time and went through the year meeting with the SLCTA group. We had more teachers and administrators on the panel and had some assistance from a colleague outside the district who brought in a book that was written by Charlotte Danielson and her framework for teaching. And that rubric became the basis of our discussion and whether or not that could be the framework for our new evaluation system. As it turns out, over those discussions, it really was solidified, I would say, in our discussions that this really was a great tool that we could use to, as Dr. Prater talked today in our cognitive coaching meeting, to begin a conversation in our district about what good instruction looks like, good classroom instruction. Met, developed all the papers for it, what the actual evaluation documents look like, the observation documents, all those things were determined by that group. And unfortunately, we kind of came to the end of the year last year and hadn't had a decision yet and really didn't feel like we could bring this decision to the teachers yet without getting them more information. So after the course of the summer, and this was all agreed on with the SLCTA, we got back together. I think one of the most important things we did over the past month was either Mr. Robinette, myself, members of this committee that got together, we went to every single site. We talked to the staff about it. We addressed any concerns they had. And walking away from those meetings, there really was a positive feeling about this new evaluation instrument. On our first day back with all the staff, as you know, Lynn Sawyer came, gave kind of a brief overview as well to all the staff members about what the rubric looked like, kind of what this means to them. And I'm happy to say that we found out last Thursday that the SLCTA group, our teachers union, has approved our new evaluation document. And with that comes a retroactive raise percentage as well, and that goes to our retirees last year as well, just so that you know, because it goes all the way back to July 1, 2011. So we are very excited, to be quite honest with you, in terms of what this will mean to our district. That, you know, evaluation in the past in terms of the conversations, the dialogues that happen between administrators and teachers, that the level of conversation is going to be, you know, just outstanding compared to maybe what it's been in the past. And so that framework, that rubric, I feel like it's going to mean a lot to our kids, to our students, and it's definitely going to help our teachers with their instruction.
Great. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board on this item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Dr. Eisenrath-Rogers.
Can you explain, Mr. Pinkerton, the hold harmless notion so the year goes by?
Yeah, so that's a good point, and I know it was in there. So this year, we know, you know, it's a new document. It's with veteran teachers, they pick 8 components, new teacher, 22 components. So there's still some room for change modifications in terms of how this is going to actually work. And so we need to kind of go through this year, try it with our administrators and our teachers, and then get staff surveys. Have the group meet again, determine what worked, what didn't. Are there little modifications that need to be made in terms of the, you know, the formatting, those types of things. But make no mistake, the new evaluation document itself is Charlotte Danielson's framework. So that will go on. So the details about how we use the document are things that we'll continue to work on over the course of the year. Now, there's a rubric scale. There's tracks that teachers are put on, possibly. So there is kind of an improvement track as part of this process so that if they have, you know, a majority of basic areas where they need to continue and get some help to improve, they would be put in, let's say, track 3. So for this first year, the pilot aspect of it is nobody, no matter what happens through this year in terms of the feedback, the rubric score the teachers will get, nobody will be put in track 3 this year. So that's the whole harmless aspect of it. They will still get notified. They'll still understand maybe the areas that they need to work on and that...
Even if they score in the basic category in several of these areas, they won't be on an improvement plan the following year?
So we currently going into this year,
right,
have have nobody that's in the par process. All right. So we should be okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. I think you're looking for a motion to ratify the new teacher evaluation system. Would someone like to make that motion?
I'll be happy to make that motion.
Okay, it's been moved by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mr. Quesenberry. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. All in favor? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just thinking partly about Ed Denton and how far we've come in our relations with our bargaining units and just the cooperation, and it's so exciting, and this is so representative of the evolution over these years, and I'm just thrilled with it.
We really want to breed that trust with our teachers from an administration teacher standpoint. So this whole process has felt like one that's built that, and so hopefully we can. That's why we want to see how it works, make changes if we need to, and continue that. Thank you.
Okay. Let's try that again. Let's bring it back to no problem. Let's bring it back to the board for a vote. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 7-0. Thank you very much. Let's go to item number 9.05, biennial review of conflict of interest code. Mrs. Holmes.
Okay. I think the board showed some foresight a few years ago when we adopted the Fair Political Practices Commission regulations, meaning that when we do these reviews every 2 years, we are no longer faced with having to rewrite all of our own regulations. We know that those have been updated, and we just follow those rules as they are amended, and they update those as the law requires. But a portion of our code includes the exhibit that you see on the screen that specifies the positions in our district who are required to report under conflict of interest. So the change that we are asking to make reflects some changes in titles and the new positions for the directors of learning and achievement. And that is the action that we're asking of you tonight so that you could approve that. What happens next is we will forward this to the Board of Supervisors, who is the body that approves all of these for agencies who have conflicts of interest. And once they approve the change, those will go into effect. So these positions will be required to file those statements next year. I do want to announce or reinforce that was said in the agenda item, because many of you have heard of some recent legislation. Mr. Buckman especially is talking about those new laws about reporting requirements or disclosure requirements, restrictions on what you're allowed to accept as gifts and honorariums or what you have to disclose. And so there are some very serious new changes to those regulations, and though we don't have to write those into our policy, we do need to make sure that we get a hold of all that information and communicate that for you and all the other reporting people before these reports are asked of you for next year. So just keep that in the back of your mind. So if you don't have any questions, I would ask that you make a motion to approve this change to our exhibit. If not, I'm here for your questions.
Anybody from the public that would like to address us? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Quesenberry?
I want to move approval of the biannual review of the Conflict of Interest Code and the changes that have been made.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second that, and I would also like to express my appreciation for staff, meaning Kim's assistance each year in going through this process.
Thank you, Kim. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion from board members? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. Let's move on to our action consent agenda. Item number 10.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.02, approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization. 10.03, disposition of surplus property. 10.04, acceptance of donations. 10.05, approval of purchase orders.
10.06, approval of warrants and payroll. 10.07, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement. 10.08, action to reject late claim against the district. Culpepper will recuse himself on this. I'll make a motion to accept item number 10.08. Would someone like to second that?
I'll second it.
Seconded by Mrs. Sheffer. Any discussion from the public? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Any discussion from the board? Seeing none, I'll take it for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 11.02, advanced agenda. Does anybody have anything that they would like to bring forth for the advanced agenda? Okay, seeing no one, I'll bring it to item 12.01, ROP board report. Mr. Buckman.
Actually,
Mr. Beckman was unable to attend due to a religious holiday, so Mr. Quisenberry stepped in for me.
Okay.
Yes, I did, and managed to get a very nice meal out of it. So, they'll all line up for it, I know. I want to report some of the things from the ROP-ROC meeting. The meeting dealt with some issues of consolidation. They're also facing, like the school districts themselves, a reduction in income, and so they had to consolidate one of their positions there to an assistant to the superintendent. So they consolidated a position, and that was a money-saving item for them. They reported that actually the growth of the ROP program and enrollment, even while they're experiencing reduced income, there was a discussion of the availability of online classes, including to Coast Union, Coast Unified, I'm sorry, students, and whether or not there would be some cost to Coast Unified associated with that. We had an opportunity to tour the new facilities at Arroyo Grande High School that are ROP and ag related. They have two new buildings. I would say one is certainly an updated metal fabrication. And there are other shops that are beautiful buildings. They're set up so that the students have Wi-Fi access, and they're being used for both the ag science and for ROP classes. And I did want to mention that their Culinary Academy students prepared the food and served the food, and I was very impressed, as I've been impressed with the culinary program, both in Arroyo Grande and the Paso Robles. It's a quite a good program, and most of the students that were there reported that they're already getting there's already an interest from some of the restaurants in the area to hire them. So it's a real nice type of program. It shows that it can be a transition for students right to the world of work. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's move on to item 12.02, reports by board members. Is there any board member that would like to make a report this evening? Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. I became aware of and was able to attend a California Green Schools Summit, and will be sharing some of the findings I came away with staff, and I'm just going to share those findings. But it was pretty exciting.
Okay. Before we adjourn, I just think I want to just let everybody know that we'll be meeting October 16th at Los Osos Middle School. Very exciting, since we've had that as a great topic of discussion tonight. So on that note, this meeting is adjourned.